I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The nonstop news coverage last weekend of hurricane-turned-tropical storm Irene has generated a debate about whether it was excessive or responsible. Some say the media helped to save lives and provided a valuable service to the public. Media critic Howard Kurtz said cable news was utterly swept away by the notion that Irene would turn out to be Armageddon. Our guest Ronald Bishop is the author of a book called More, The Vanishing of Scale in an Over-the-Top Nation. He looks at the media's obsessive and relentless coverage of news and trivialities, its focus on conflict, the promotion and popularity of reality shows, and believes they come with a price. He says we've lost all sense of proportion and outrage because everything is supersized. He pines for the days of simpler pleasures and wonders in his book whether he sounds like a ranting baby boomer. We will find out. He's a professor of communication at Drexel University and joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Ron Bishop, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So are you a ranting baby boomer?
Probably, in part, a little bit. It's interesting that Irene is sort of the topic that starts us off, because there was debate actually on the air. Several stations that I had been watching during that time were arguing amongst each other as to whether or not they were being over the top in their coverage. And swept away is a particularly interesting phrase for Howard Kurtz to throw in there.
Well, it is. And have you come to a conclusion yourself about whether you think that coverage was over the top or not? And I should add that the pictures coming in from upstate New York and from Vermont, I'm not sure that's exactly what Armageddon looks like, but it looks pretty bad.
Well, I think that for the most part, it was what I had seen in between dealing with our own Irene experience, I guess. There's always a level of responsibility. I mean, none of this is to say that journalists aren't doing their job well or they're not being professional. It's just the sort of the approach or the tone that seems to accompany any or every, you know, fairly large scale story these days. That every storm possibly could be Armageddon. Every event is sort of announced or pronounced at such a large volume that it just makes me wonder how the audience for a radio show, television show, television news program reacts or makes use of that information.
Where do you think that intensity comes from? Is it the fact that we live in such a media-saturated world? You've got stations that are highly competitive with each other.
Definitely. I think that's a huge part of it. And I try to make the point early on that this is certainly not new. I mean, this is the fact that intensity or sort of out-of-scale behavior in the media, driving media content, is certainly not a new thing. I mean, the fact that we are, as you pointed out, such a media-saturated, or living in such a media-saturated time, has a lot to do with it, because folks who work for newspapers, news organizations, CNN, folks who have to fill that kind of time every day are looking for ways to sustain audience. The flip side of that, I think, and Daniel Boorstin, who was the Librarian of Congress years ago, made this point in a great book called The Image, that the holes that these folks have to fill when events like Irene aren't happening the typical day lead to a reliance on manufactured news. Again, having worked on the public relations side for a little while, this is not an indictment. It's just an observation that we see so much prepackaged, so much, as I said before, manufactured content when things aren't sort of unfolding quickly like Irene or the debt crisis, that we sort of lose a sense of, when things are sort of normal or quiet, and we think everything is sort of happening at a fever pitch all the time, when that's not the case. And it creates sort of this idea that, as Boorstin observed almost 50 years ago, that, there's just not that much real news as we might define it, or a journalism professor like me might define
meaning
it.
Meaning new. News is something that's new.
Like breaks through the routine that informs, entertains, edifies, educates. There's just a sort of a lack of that because of as you pointed out, just the demands, the sheer demands that such saturation places on folks working in the media.
Well, I notice when there is news as defined by the media, it comes with music. mm-hmm. and graphics and, you know, some of this hyperbolic language.
Definitely. Everything has to be, and the assumption is, I mean, this is driven by, you know, I'm sure shelves full of audience research that says that, you know, this is what our audience expects, and in order to sustain the audience and hopefully make it grow, that they want the packaging. Mm-hmm. They want the war in Iraq, you know, having its own graphics package and labels and music, as you pointed out. Coverage of Hurricane Katrina. I'm thinking specifically of Anderson Cooper, a fine reporter with, you know, lots of, I don't want to say color necessarily, but just it was a very packaged attempt to drive the points that he was trying to make home, mm-hmm. rather than relying on just the observations and the nature of, and his skill as a reporter, which is, you know, considerable, to make the points for him.
Although I do remember he did some tough questioning down
definitely.
There in New Orleans.
No doubt. And what I worry about, I guess, as a former journalist and as, you know, as a professor in this arena, is that the personality parts, the packaging parts, sort of take precedence mm-hmm. in making judgments about, you know, what we're going to cover and how we're going to cover it if we're you know, thinking as Anderson Cooper or as a news director for a station, that you know, it's enough. And I always tell my students that truth is definitely enough. I mean, the truth of a situation, what's actually happening, even though the stories are manufactured and you're selecting elements. You know, what's actually going on the ground, whether it's, you know, in Paterson, New Jersey, after the storm, after Hurricane Irene, is plenty, mm-hmm. plenty impactful, plenty powerful to keep people riveted. And when you sort of overload that with, you know, all the intensity and the helicopters and everything else, it just sort of muddles the message.
And reporters standing and being buffeted by, you know, 80-mile right. an hour winds. But I wonder whether the public understands. I mean, obviously, news organizations are looking for audience, but it seems to me that people are pretty savvy about the media culture that we live in.
Well, perhaps. I mean, I think, and it goes back to your comment about saturation, I think we are maybe the most media savvy generation, if that's maybe,
or maybe
not overstepping.
Our children are, but yes,
right.
exactly. As opposed to us.
All my students teaching me how to use these new devices.
Exactly.
Being dragged, kicking and screaming into the Facebook era. But yes, I think we definitely see a lot more knowledge of how folks in the media construct news stories on air, whether it's print, on air, online. But one of the things that may be doing is sort of shifting the focus for a reader or for mm-hmm. an online visitor to the process rather than the product. The knowledge that, you know, it takes, that seeing things behind the scenes, even something as simple as a gaggle of cameras at a presidential news conference, mm-hmm. let's say, shifts the audience, their attention to how something is made, mm-hmm. sort of the old argument about sausage, I guess, mm-hmm. or the metaphor, and away from what the president or whomever it is giving a press conference is saying. And the folks who are on that side of the fence, the folks who are making those messages, know this or create it with that in mind. Limiting an audience for a presidential visit, whether it's, you know, Republican or Democrat, making sure that all the images or the optics, the term that gets thrown around a lot, are just so, rather than letting, you know, allowing the candidate to speak, yeah,
without
exactly.
being interrupted or interpreted while they are speaking. Because oftentimes cameras will turn away. I mean, there's someone giving a speech, and then after a couple of minutes, the focus is on the newscaster who's telling you what they just said or what they are saying.
Exactly, and giving their interpretation. And in a way, and this kind of brings us a little bit back to the discussion we had about Anderson Cooper, who, as, again, you know, a fine reporter. He was criticized by some folks, some observers, mm-hmm. some academics, for inserting himself into the story, becoming part of the story, which, you know, it's certainly been a while for me, but editors and former professors of mine said was kind of like the number one rule mm-hmm. of
you're not
good
the
reporting.
Story.
Exactly. You're not the story. You just kind of let the facts on the ground, wherever you are, whatever it is, mm-hmm. sort of tell the story, and then let the reader decide, or the visitor or the viewer decide for themselves what's going on. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, research that, you know, tells a news director or a general manager or an editor for a newspaper that that's what the reader wants to see. And so the shift from kind of this idea of news that we need, sort of and this is an oversimplification, but sort of the Walter Cronkite model of reporting.
Oh, boy, you are showing your age. But
yeah, really.
Go ahead.
The Walter Cronkite, maybe move it forward, I guess.
Yeah,
Dan
right.
Rather, I mean, model of reporting versus, you know, what we see today, where the struggle, as you hinted at before, to sustain audience, to make money, to make profits, to satisfy shareholders, the shift to a model of news or a model of any media content that pushes what they want, you know, what they want rather than sort of the difference between eating your vegetables and having, you know, sweets all the time. That's a concern.
But it seems like what you're saying, and I think you can observe this from time to time, is just the personalization of news, the idea that this person, and frankly, Walter Cronkite, when he spoke, I mean, the world listened at that point.
It sure did.
I mean, he was a celebrity in his own right, not in the sort of celebrity-soaked culture that we live in today. But, you know, that was a pretty powerful perch he had.
It was, and I think maybe the difference might be that it wasn't sort of a, at least at the beginning when he started, from what I know of his career and some work that some colleagues of mine have done in his life, he didn't see it that way. It was at a time when, in the late 40s, early 50s, when he was breaking into broadcasting, that news was sort of still seen as a prestige thing, a lost leader, to draw a parallel with marketing and consumer behavior, that sort of got people into the tent. It sort of drove the image of the station or the image of the network, in his case. And after a while, certainly maybe a little longer period than, you know, contemporary accounts of his life have sort of, when he passed away a few years ago, indicated, he became Uncle Walter. He became the most trusted man in America.
Yes.
And he, for the most part, didn't use that to package, didn't play that up. It wasn't part of the I guess marketing maybe wasn't as much of a thought then or as much of a key part of the equation as it is now, that, you know, there was no, you know, Walter Cronkite presents or, you know, graphics package. It was just a straight reporting of the news most of the time. I mean, there were those instances where his emotions got the best of him, and that he was, you know, lost his composure briefly when JFK was assassinated. But it was still, as he said, late in life, in sort of
and
observing.
I don't think that was manufactured.
No,
I
mean, that was very genuine.
A moment of real emotion in a live broadcast.
Definitely. And it was rare. But now it's sort of the other way.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation, talking with Ronald Bishop today on Radio Times. He's got a new book. It's called More, and it has a picture of a giant pig on the cover and is subtitled The Vanishing of Scale in an Over-the-Top Nation. If you want to give us a call, and we'd love to have you give us a call, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Do you think we have lost all sense of proportion, and is it the media's fault? Give us a call, 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. Continuing education at PAFA has art classes and workshops this fall in drawing, painting, sculpture, printmaking, and more. Featuring Saturday classes for high school students, art appreciation in the PAFA Museum, and master classes with classical realist artist and author Juliet Aristides and noted painters Bill Scott and Stuart Shills. PAFA CE, a community of artists of all ages and levels. Classes begin September 8th. For details, pafa.edu/CE.
The WHYY Connections Festival kicks off Friday night with a free screening of Ken Burns' Prohibition. Saturday, Dr. Dog, The Baseball Project, Justin Townsend, Bertie Bush, and Koofnauts live on stage.
South Street in the summer, parade with the mamas.
The WHYY Connections Festival at the Great Plaza at Penn's Landing. Free for everyone with special events for WHYY members. Labor Day weekend's best free festival. WHYY.org/connectionsfestival.
On the next Humankind, Life expectancy in this country was 47 in 1900, and it's close to 80 now, and among some ethnic groups, it's over 80.
With extra time, many people are starting new careers later in life.
Next time on Humankind.
Monday night at 6 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and if you're just joining us, Ron Bishop is our guest today on the show, professor of communication at Drexel University here in Philadelphia. He's written several books, and the newest one is called More, The Vanishing of Scale in an Over-the-Top Nation. And we have calls coming in to 1-888-477-9499. Let me just find out whether you were talking about Walter Cronkite, and of course that was the time of a couple of channels, broadcast channels, and some newspapers, and that's where we got our news. Today, of course, a much bigger menu, many more choices that we have. Do you think we're better off today that we have access to so much more media, even if it's delivered at this high rate of intensity and crisis?
I don't mean to give you, I guess, a cop-out answer, but I'm not sure. I mean, there are days certainly where, as during Hurricane Irene or during some of the major events, the earthquake we had, a very surprising earthquake here in the area, that it gets to be a glut of information going along with the theme of the book, that there's so much out there and it's so available, and that if you sort of persuade the audience to think that they have to go to hundreds of sources to make a picture or create a, you know, a decent account of what's going on, no matter what the story is.
Sure.
It's more work for them and may not necessarily inform them as much or educate them as much as the mission of being a news person specifically would indicate, that there's just too much to go through. I mean, I feel that, and again, as we were kind of laughing about before, it could just be, you know, advancing age in my case. But
I'm not here to diagnose you.
No,
just so you know.
It's totally accurate in my case. But that, you know, when something, even like a maybe on a smaller scale happens, mm-hmm. the thought that you have to then dip into, you know, 10 different places online, on television, in the newspaper, to get a complete picture rather than being able to go. And this, again, not mm-hmm. a necessarily criticism, but thinking that you only have to go to one, the Cronkite sort of model,
sure.
again, occurring at a time when we had fewer choices, is pretty troubling. And I'm not sure, there isn't a lot of research out there necessarily to sort of gauge that impact yet. But it does sort of make me wonder if, you know, the public then becomes maybe a little scattered as well in their sort of in paying attention to what's going on.
Well, you say an interesting thing in the book, and wondering whether when things are just at such a relentless and intense level, whether we risk the loss of outrage, you know, knowing if everything is over the top, you know, what is even over the top of
right.
that?
I think that's true. I mean, the story I kind of tell my students in some of my journalism classes is that when Woodward and Bernstein were researching and writing their stories about the Watergate scandal and moving to the aftermath of that after right. President Nixon resigned, they were sort of treated as rock stars, as folks, even though there are conflicting accounts about how much their reporting actually, you know, compelled Nixon to resign. Some really cool.
It was part of a narrative, for
right?
Sure.
Exactly, and you know, it was sort of one place to go or several places to go. To go back to your earlier thought that you know, it was the Washington Post, the Times, a little bit later, and then CBS and some of the other networks. But that seems to have changed, that, and I'm not sure of the reasons necessarily, but mm-hmm. that folks, because they're hit with so much about so many different things, they kind of lose the ability or seem to be losing the ability to get really angry when something horrible happens. Instead, and it may be an unfortunate example, but they get angry at the Anthony Weiner scandal. They get angry. That apparently drives them. Drives folks crazy. They find that, and you know, his conduct certainly was not wonderful. But when something real that affects their lives happens, then there's sort of this onslaught of information and then a lack, maybe just because they can't digest it all and make sense of what's going on. And I could certainly put myself in that category, that they sort of lose the ability, or it's sort of watered down their ability to get rightfully angry. And part of that has to do very quickly with something you mentioned before, the idea of personalization. The danger with personalizing stories, very complex stories, is that you end up moving attention away from any kind of systemic change that might happen. I mean, if you sort of personalize the debt crisis as a battle between President Obama and Speaker Boehner, folks pay attention to that and yet may not be learning exactly what caused it in the first place, where they really should have sort of a large-scale reaction. They should be angry that that's happening. Instead, they get angry about the over-the-top sort of behavior.
Well, let me just—we're a small fish here at Radio Times, but it is interesting when there is a breaking story that there is the impulse to, you know, drop everything you're doing and jump on that story,
mm-hmm.
and try to you know, beat everyone to the punch. But I've learned over time, and it doesn't always work out this way, that sometimes the story, while it breaks very fast, over time you learn what the sort of story beneath the story is.
Right.
And if you wait a couple of days, then there's a whole fresh way of looking at something that seemed one way on Monday, and by Thursday it looks like something else.
Their explanations emerge, other ideas. Yeah, and I think the danger is that folks will pay more attention, as the example we were using about the debt crisis, to that, and then they're not paying attention by Thursday or Friday when
they're off to something else,
right? Exactly,
you know, their crisis story that's out there.
And this is not to make a couch potato, you know, led around by the nose sort of argument about the audience. It's just there's a lot out there, and when it's very sort of loud and vibrant, mm-hmm. you know, attention moves to the next loud and vibrant thing rather than giving folks enough time to sit and think and consider and ponder the ramifications of, you know, what the debt crisis means to them, or what unemployment lines mean to them, the more vivid pictures.
But I also think that the public is just much more empowered to find the news that they want. I mean, it may take them to these sort of news segregated worlds, but nonetheless, you know, you're not dependent on a handful of people to tell you about the world. You can find the world yourself.
True, and that's a good thing. As my, you know, sort of nightly, you know, researching people on Wikipedia, it's a weird habit, will attest. But on the other hand, you know, it sort of signals the demise of sort of these great central places where in the news, you know, in media, where folks, and again, sort of showing my age, but like Walter Cronkite's newscast or NBC's newscast or one of the New York Times or large newspapers, where folks can always go one place to find very good journalism, good reporting, for the most part, down the middle, unideological assessments of what's going on. I think that is sort of an offshoot or a byproduct of the expansion, the mushrooming of media sources. It's a wonderful thing.
Yep.
Don't get me wrong. That, yep. you know, to be able to hop on the internet and find out, you know, not remembering a person, to be able to look them up and have 14 sites about,
it's a gift.
You know, the Grassroots from the 1970s. You know, that's, you know, as a fan of that music. But on the other hand, you know, is that information accurate? Who's running the website? Who's putting it up there? And that, when you have Cronkite, even though there are certainly flaws and, you know, warts and pimples in reporting, metaphorically speaking, you know generally mm-hmm. what you're going to get.
And that's Ronald Bishop, our guest today on Radio Times, professor of communication at Drexel University here in Philadelphia, and the author of a new book called More, The Vanishing of Scale in an Over-the-Top Nation. Let's get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Having a hard time multitasking here on Radio Times. Let me see what Tony from Princeton has to say. Tony, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
I'm a photojournalist. I've been in the business for over 25 years. Yeah. And Mr. Bishop, I really want to take issue with the fact that you've sort of been lumping newspapers in with your discussion about television news media and the fact that, you know, the 24-hour news cycle has sort of become more about entertainment and feeding the news monster than you know, really providing, you know, solid, deep coverage of events. And, you know, for the organization I've worked for the last several years, you know, I can say with conviction that the style of our coverage and the way we provide information to our readers really hasn't changed in a significant way, despite, you know, the culture of the new news media.
It's a good point, Tony. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Ron, go ahead.
I think, first of all, I'm really happy to hear that, and I appreciate taking the time to call. Again, none of this, and I hope I made that point fairly clear early on, that, you know, is an indictment or criticism of folks in the field who are out doing really wonderful work. It's just more an observation about what kinds of stories or what kinds of approaches to coverage seem to be, and there certainly is room for discussion and disagreement, seem to be sort of holding sway or dominating the discussion or sort of the movement to covering, for example, if you look at most coverage of strikes between, you know, labor and management, there is, and print certainly has the space and the skill to go a little bit more in depth and talk about, you know, why a union is going on strike, a teacher's union, for example. But again, on television and online and on blogs, which sort of expand things even further, it's a similar story package every time. One side, you know, there's a shot of people with picket signs, they're angry parents, you know, what am I going to do? I have to get a babysitter for my child.
Kind of stereotypic stories?
Yeah, stereotypical in the sense that it's sort of the same recipe or the same package every time. And that's really, so long as the information gets out there, and that's fine. But if that's the only way that that particular kind of story gets coverage or is covered in that way, then it's not giving the audience the information they need necessarily.
And Tony talked about the news monster. Mm-hmm. I mean, that it must be fed, and cable feeds it oftentimes through conflict.
Definitely. I mean, and I think that just even the term news monster, which in his, you know, in Tony's very eloquent comment, I think signals. We didn't have necessarily a 24-hour news cycle in the past or a monster that had to be fed. And when it's fed, some of the stuff it's fed, just mm-hmm. like as we were talking about before, some of the stuff, you know, we eat, I guess, as a society, isn't that
nutritious?
Doesn't stick to the ribs. Doesn't, yeah, exactly. Isn't that nutritious? That stories that aren't necessarily newsworthy get covered just again to feed the monster. And we get conflict. We get black hats and white hats, simplistic coverage sometimes of issues that maybe merit a little bit more perspective. And again, not to say that doesn't happen, that there are incredible journalists for, you know, the Post and the Times and even certainly broadcasting that do a good job with that. But in the push to sustain audience, especially a young audience, which is supposedly moving away in droves, you know, to the internet, certain changes or certain approaches are favored over others. And so certain ways of telling stories are favored, and certain folks, groups of people who can tell those stories well in a packaged sense get a little bit more, a better seat at the table.
Sure, a lot more attention.
Right, to continue our sort of our...
I think we know who some of those people are.
Food metaphor.
They keep showing up. Let me get Lou from Hatfield to join our conversation. And Lou, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi there.
Hello there.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi,
Lou.
I'm interested in the idea that of this vanishing scale extending to the larger culture. I'm a Temple University grad student in archaeology, so I study material culture, vernacular architecture, and I see that suburban buildings are completely out of scale when you consider their purpose. You know, we've got up here in Hatfield, we've got strip malls that look like French chateaux with, you know, crenellated towers and turrets. And the most interesting one to me, at least, is the Merck Credit Union, which has 6-foot-wide columns and 5-foot-high letters that wrap around the thing, and it's only a one-story building. How do you think this ties into the sort of things that you're talking about?
Lou, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. What do you say, Ron?
It absolutely does tie in, and we were chatting before we came on the air about the idea of McMansions as well, that even though in a down economy we don't see maybe as many of those as we used to, the urge for a corporation like Merck to, you know, sustain or even burnish its public image, where that might have led them – decades ago to build a more sedate. I'm certainly not an architect and don't know, can't keep my different types of architecture straight, but that they want to make a presence felt. It's sort of similar to something that, you know, we talk about in the book about, you know, even young kids through their different activities and accomplishments, building a legacy for having parents talk about their children building a legacy now by being the best at soccer or ballet or whatever it is, or one of the many activities that they engage in. It's partially about keeping attention, partially about, you know, maybe a little bit of ego mixed in. That, and again, it's certainly not new necessarily, but we certainly see more of it today that organizations want to put the best, loudest, brashest possible public face on who they are so that it, you know, draws our attention to it rather than us looking at another building that, you know, isn't quite
as lavish.
As lavish.
Luth, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And just segueing from that to, you know, the size of a large soda or even a large cup of coffee, and I'm doing this on the radio, so no one can see it except for you and Kevin, our engineer, but just that there's no such thing as just large. It's all, if you go to the movies, it's gigantic.
Gigantic, exactly. I mean, it boggles the mind. You sit there at the...
How can you drink at that much in one sitting?
I was just going to say, you know, 64 ounces of soda. Mm-hmm. We were talking about how there's no such thing, or at least it's less prominent or less emphasized as small anymore. Mm-hmm. Small is a bad thing. It's a pejorative that, you know, an 8-ounce soda isn't enough. I think a lot of the arguments or a lot of the discussion or the dialogue around food and consumption of food is... and it's touched on also, is so extreme. I mean, if you we are, and again, not to debate the statistics, we are in the grips of an obesity epidemic in the yes. country. But even calling it and referring to it as an obesity epidemic, rather than maybe taking a step back and not that doctors aren't helping kids deal with this, but, you know, labeling it that for the purpose of discussion may sort of accelerate or misdirect sort of people's understanding of what's going on. And then...
Because if it's an epidemic, it's, oh, my God.
Right. It's Armageddon. It's the sky is falling. It's Chicken Little. And then when folks are, you know, make the decision, maybe is a little older, to lose weight, we think about how we see weight loss in the media. We see shows like The Biggest Loser, where folks are denigrated, you know, and made to do all kinds of really strange activities, manufactured activities, as part of their effort to lose weight. And not that, you know, the weight loss isn't a good, healthy thing to do.
Right. And these people do sign up. It's not like they've been kidnapped for the show.
That's right. They volunteer and sign all kinds of release forms, I'm sure. But it's the accelerated rate at which they are called on, demanded, I guess, by the producers of the show to lose the weight, and the dialogue that happens, you know, sort of paralleling the usual reality show behind the scenes machinations about, you know, who's aligned with who and that kind of thing. But just how weight is framed, how their weight loss is framed on the show is very urgent. And, you know, in some cases it is, but that message, you know, in a show that's very popular, sends a different message.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Ronald Bishop today on Radio Times. And we're talking about his book called More, The Vanishing of Scale in an Over-the-Top Nation. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Drexel University supports WHYY. If you are at least 20 pounds overweight, you may be eligible to participate in a research study called Project Well at Drexel University. This year-long weight loss study is sponsored by the National Institutes of Health and is designed to help adult participants lose weight and keep it off without medication. Guidance from weight loss specialists at group meetings is included. For more information, 215-762-1111. 215-762-1111. On the next Fresh Air, as All You Can Eat Week continues, we listen back to our 1989 interview with the late Julia Child, the original TV chef who popularized French food in the U.S. Also, some kitchen advice from Harold McGee, an expert on the science of food and cooking. Join us. This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll look at a little-known Catholic school that's been graduating some of the country's top female leaders. Also, carving cameos out of Oreos, a sculptor of edible art. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen talking with Ronald Bishop today on the show. He sees, as he looks around the world, that everything is supersized. It's bigger, it's better, it's faster, it's louder. He says that many people feel pressure to fill their days with life-altering experiences, and even little things, he says, have taken on a momentous significance. And why have we lost all sense of proportion? Well, he says, take a look at this relentless media. And that's what he writes about in his new book called More. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get, looks like Zach from New Orleans to join our conversation. And Zach, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
My question is mostly about satire now. It seems like that's the only place to get any balance from the onslaught. You know, back in the 70s, Network, I think, was incredibly prophetic, but it seems subtle now. And it's like the only place that you're able to get any balance or perspective is through shows like The Daily Show or Colbert Report, where they've got the time to sit back, analyze what's been reported on. But then they're reporting on the reporting, not the actual event. But it kind of is the only place to give you any perspective from the shouting.
Well, Zach, I appreciate the fact that you called in, because I wanted to talk about The Daily Show and Stephen Colbert. And to be honest with you, I agree with Zach's assessment, which is that these are places that takes a look at the media, that really puts, especially The Daily Show, puts a harsh spotlight on the media and shows its many foibles and failings. Ron?
They do. And I think Zach's absolutely right. I mean, they've sort of become those great central spaces, as we were talking about before with in our discussion about Walter Cronkite and the CBS Evening News. That has Jon Stewart's show and Stephen Colbert show have sort of become that for us, the place to go for, as Zach was saying, analysis and proper skewering of, you know, public figures and the media, certainly. One of the things I would just toss into that discussion is that neither of those folks, and I know Jon Stewart has said this publicly, it's not that they don't embrace the role. It's not that they don't appreciate, you know, the vast audience that they've picked up over the years. And they're both incredibly skilled artists, comedians. Neither of them want that mantle.
No, they don't.
Jon Stewart has said repeatedly that he, and in a very famous appearance, one of my favorite moments in politics over the last, maybe ever, his appearance a few years back in Crossfire with Paul Begala and Tucker Carlson, you know, he
took them down
quite well, I thought. I mean, that's just me. But he constantly was saying during that discussion, and I'm certainly paraphrasing, that he's a comedian who's doing the job that these two guys, specifically in that instance, are supposed to be doing, and are sort of lost in some of the things we've been discussing during the show today, that they are more interested in the entertainment that Stewart is actually providing, that making news, sort of transforming news into an entertainment vehicle, sort of building irony upon irony, that Jon Stewart is doing, but is getting credit for being a journalist, which he completely, you know, disavows.
But from my perspective, he is the court jester in the traditional sense of the word, in that he can say things to the king that other people, if they said to the king, they would be beheaded, you know, going back 500 years or so. But he can say the king has no clothes. And that's, to me, that is such an important role. Whether you call him a journalist or a comedian or whatever he calls himself, it's such an important role for someone to play, especially in this hyper-saturated, reactive, overreactive media world.
But I agree. But what I would say is that the fact that he, and maybe he does this for that reason, his constant stressing or emphasizing that he's just a comedian, it gives him sort of a layer of protection in a way. I mean, he's able to do that, to say things to Dick Cheney or to Barack Obama or people in power, that because it's an entertainment show, and we don't necessarily, although, you know, myself and Zach and other fans of the shows certainly turn to him for that now, we don't necessarily expect or think that he's going to be doing that as a function of the show. I mean, he's sort of fallen into that role maybe because there's less of it, there's less of that kind of information coming from sources that we've grown up to expect it coming from, which is a really bad sentence. But and so as a result, you know, it's just an entertainment show. It's just Jon Stewart, you know.
See, I disagree. I mean, okay. I think it is an entertainment show, but I think that his and it's his political analysis, and again, his kind of takedown of the powerful people in politics and media is really unparalleled. And I think, I don't care what he calls himself, but I feel like if you are an informed news person and you go to that show, he will tell you something you don't know. And he will do what traditional media often doesn't do, which is to hold people's hypocritical words up against them. You know, he goes back and into the archives, pulls out a tape from 10 years ago and says, you know, here's what Dick Cheney said this, and here's what he says today.
And it's a very valuable function, and I'm not at all downplaying that. I mean, I think, you know, there has always throughout the history of the media, at least in the United States, been this debate about education versus entertainment. Mm-hmm. And whenever a new medium would launch or would become, sort of insert itself into our lives, television, radio, newspapers further back, there would be, you know, very wonderful sounding things said by corporate executives who would say, yes, we're going to, you know, use this instrument to teach rather than just entertain. Mm-hmm. And of course, when entertainment proves to be more profitable than educating, then, you know, things happen differently.
But can't you have both?
Yes. I mean, as a, you know, with a 9-year-old and as a wonderful 9-year-old who loves Barney and loves, you know, Sesame Street and Elmo.
Sure.
Absolutely. And they're wonderful shows, Mr. Rogers and things like that. But even in those cases, if you look at, you know, the changes in how those shows are produced, how Sesame Street even has evolved over the years, still a wonderful show, still incredibly educational. But, you know, the movement away from sort of the Martin Luther King-inspired notion when the show was launched in the late 60s to a time, and not to be glib about it, where, you know, Cookie Monster, which was, you know, the real over-the-top character in the show, or one of them, is now, you know, hawking, you know, eating healthy. He too has become a pundit. He too has become, it's just not enough for Cookie Monster to be cute and fuzzy and, you know, scarf everything down. He has to now take also the role, as Jon Stewart has, maybe reluctantly or not, of being the nation's food conscience, you know, or at least for little kids. And
yes.
I think that, you know, it again comes back to me to, you know, the quality of the information. This is, there's always a debate, and I think you've talked about this in other venues, about the Harry Potter phenomenon in reading. There, you know, folks, not the folks who come out and say, well, it's, you know, against the church and they shouldn't be teaching magic and all that kind of stuff, but, you know, the folks who argue that it's sort of fast food for little kids, that the reading all the books so much, so fast, being in line when they come out and the movies come out, over-the-top behavior for sure. And then the other camp says, well, even though it's entertaining, to get back to your point, very entertaining and wonderful, that they're reading.
Yeah.
You know, we can't get them to read.
Reading with passion.
Right,
and with
exactly.
Intense
right.
interest.
And when with Harry Potter, it always reminds me of when I was in sixth grade, my teacher created this reading competition for us. We had to read the most books we could in the school year. And so, you know, I was neck and neck with this other person in the class. And now that's, again, to maybe extend it a little bit, that's sort of the norm. There's it's a key example of what, you know, we talk about, that every activity, it seems, at least how it's portrayed in the media, has to be undertaken with such zeal, not taking anything away from the passion. And
because I think at least with Harry Potter, it was the children. I mean, it was the readers that was driving the intensity of Harry Potter. I mean, I think they would have done it without whatever the media said about it.
I would definitely agree. I mean, and, you know, it's how, when the last movie came out, especially, it made me think of it again, that, you know, it's always the lines, it's always the kids in the glasses with the scar, tattoos.
So cute, though.
They are. They're extremely cute. And, you know, this is not, and they're wonderful books, but it's, again, the journalist or the media person sitting there observing that and thinking, okay, this is the behavior I'm going to put on the air and talk about, rather than maybe just a little kid who sits in his room in Dubuque, Iowa, or whatever. Just, I like Harry Potter, and I'm going to read it. But it's fine that they're reading. I find myself as an academic always being sort of straddling that fence, that if you can make a message that might otherwise be sort of pedantic and complex, a little bit simpler, not a lot simpler, not maybe a lot over the top, but a little simpler, sort of the early Sesame Street model, sort of, you know, the Mr. Rogers idea, then that's a really good thing because it helps people understand. But if you go so far to the other side where you're just constantly, you know, making every message so intense, so out of scale, everything they participate in so out of scale, then you kind of lose that informational value a little. I mean, you know, it's...
Well, let me see what some of our callers have to say at 1-888-477-9499. We have Ed, it looks like, from Downingtown joining our conversation. Ed, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you very much for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I was wondering, does the professor think that there can be a parallel drawn between, say, the newspaper era of the late 19th, early 20th century, where it got just into these really sensationalized stories that all the newspapers carried, and they became very factionalized, and, say, the modern media, where places like Fox and MSNBC have gotten into the same really detailed, focused, factionalized reporting? And if that is a real parallel, what is the likely outcome?
Well, it's an interesting question, Ed. Thanks for calling into Radio Time. Seeing a parallel between the kind of tabloid journalism of 100 years ago and a tabloid media. Do you see that?
I do, and I think it raises a really, really good point. I mean, this is, as we said kind of at the beginning of our discussion, this is certainly not a new thing. It's just the degree of the breadth that it's achieved over the years, that the approach to reporting seems to be, or that approach, the more the sensational approach to reporting, is applied to maybe more stories than it used to be, if that makes any sense. I mean, that, you know, the... And then something to kind of go back to where we're just briefly tagging on a little bit about Jon Stewart again. I mean, the rise of the punditry, the rise of the pundit class, Eric Alterman has called it and has written about it extensively, where, you know, opinion, passing opinion off as news is news now.
And he skewers that so well.
Yes, he does. And it's a perfect sort of foil, much more, I think, because he's a great writer, eloquent foil, it's applying that approach to creating content to everything rather than just maybe one or two stories.
That everything is opinion?
That everything is opinion, that everything or most things are to be approached in a very packaged, very loud, sort of aggressive, sensational, to use Ed's words, manner. The reason I think that stories like the false story about men going to the moon and all of the ones from journalism history stick in our minds is that they're not that they were few, but there was more space between them in a way that we remember them because they were fewer and farther between, perhaps. And now, since we see every major story sort of handled that way,
blaring headlines,
as you said before, that, you know, we kind of lose or our ability to sort of pick the facts out or pick the information out from all of that is diminished.
Ed, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let's see what looks like Rick from Winfield Heights has to say. And Rick, you're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Good morning,
Mark. Good morning.
Earlier in the show, Professor Bishop said something about the Cronkite era and how there was a single place we could go to for whatever the news coverage was that we needed. And I remember being a kid and being told by my elders that it's never a good idea to get all your news from a single location. And he suggested that having so many different news sites on the Internet and whatever is not necessarily a good thing. I wondered if you could comment about that.
Rick, thanks for calling into Radio Times. I mean, it seems it's a mixed bag.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I mean, I guess what I was, is to go back to the earlier part of our discussion, it's just far more difficult to accomplish. I mean, I think you're absolutely right that it's never a good idea to rely on, you know, one source of information as, you know, as well-informed and down the middle and objective as, say, the New York Times or Walter Cronkite is. You should always look elsewhere. the nation on the left and maybe something on the right to make sure that you're getting, you know, the truth, getting finally getting at the truth. But the problem is that the direction or the path to truth has just gotten a lot more cluttered in journalism, that it's harder for a reader who has access to 100 different sources on a story, I think, to get at the truth, to finally to figure out what's actually going on. I mean, it's difficult enough because a reporter on the ground at a story is, you know, selecting and isn't sure. able necessarily to get the truth right away, as you said before. But instead of sort of being, you mentioned off the air, you know, the nation having attention deficit disorder in a sense,
and that's not the magazine, but the country, right?
Right, the country, exactly. That you know, that instead of just kind of staying on that yeah. path and trying to find Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, more information, let's expand, let's, you know, clarify. The tendency is to kind of bounce to another thing, and, you know, the next sort of shiny thing that comes up, everybody's attention goes that way.
Well, we're almost out of time here, but I understand what you're saying, but I don't think the world is going to cooperate
no.
with, you know, the future are all the shiny objects, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think as a sort of a final sort of bookend, I guess, to that, it's the suggestion also, as we were saying before, that the media sort of sell that too. I mean, there are plenty of people that, you know, folks, most folks, I would imagine, who do exactly what the caller was saying, who do try at mm-hmm. least to go and find different information, who don't buy the McMansion, who don't overreact to everything. But it's sort of a narrative that the media kind of sells to sustain itself, that everybody's out there doing, you know, very aggressive out there sort of over-the-top things.
Well, on that note, Ronald Bishop, thank you for joining us
today
on Radio Times.
For the opportunity. I appreciate it.
No, we're happy to have you. And the book is called More, The Vanishing of Scale in an Over-the-Top Nation. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. In fact, if you go to our Facebook page, you can find out what Ron Bishop looks like.
That's scary.
It's scary for all of us, believe me. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.